You are listening to The News Project for the week of June 17th, 2019, brought to you by GNAT TV. This week's episode features stories about dairy farmers who are struggling with low milk prices, part two of GNAT's home movie preservation series, Southern Vermont Art Center's new creative spaces, the start of redevelopment on Bennington's Putnam Block, and a unique piece of art featuring the Rokeby Estate, a stop on the Underground Railroad.
In a state where it was once said there are more cows than people, dairy agriculture is going through some tough times. Low milk prices have made it hard for farmers to hang in there until better times return. The number of dairy farms in Vermont has declined to less than 700, a drop of about 400 over the past 10 years. There are fewer cows, too, although that decline has been less precipitous. There's about 126,000 cows in the state today, compared to about 137,000 in 2010, according to the Vermont Department of Agriculture. But dairy agriculture is still a major part of the state's economy, as well as a cultural touchstone. So we decided to take a look at how the industry is going and adapting. One place we stopped in at was North Meadow Farm on North Road in Manchester. There we met Lisa Cross, who is the manager of the farm, which uses all the milk its cows produce in cheeses and other dairy-based products it sells in its gift shop.
We sell raw milk, we sell farm fresh eggs, we make cheese here on the farm using only our milk. We don't ship out our milk at all, so we make cheese. We have beef, grass-fed beef, and we do have a garden. We have a large garden, and we have a farm stand during the summer.
On the dairy side of things, I mean, what are some of the challenges you're seeing? How difficult is it to kind of make a living doing dairy, is the basic question.
It's very difficult. It is extremely difficult because if we were to send our milk out, we wouldn't make any money to survive. Right now, with us using all of our milk here, we can sell the raw milk at our price, like a wholesale price. There's no middleman. And we use the milk for the cheese, and the cheese is really good. And we sell the cheese here out of our store. If we had to ship out our milk, I just don't know how we'd survive because the cows, our dairy cows, require a lot of maintenance and feed. And we do all of our own haying, and we use the hay that we get in the summertime to feed during the winter. And then we also give them a little bit of grain, and we have to pay for that too, which is very expensive.
Farming has never been known to be an easy job, and that part of it hasn't changed much, she said.
That's the way it is. We are up and at it by 5 a.m. at the latest. You know, sometimes we sleep in at 5 a.m. Usually it's a 4 a.m. morning. One day a week, it's a 4 a.m. morning when I have to make cheese, because I get up at 4 a.m. because I have to pump the milk over from our milk house before they start milking. So I have to get up and do that and get the tank clean, ready for more milk to go in. We try to start milking by 6:30. You know, it takes maybe an hour and a half to 2 hours to milk and clean up. Then we have to take care of all the animals. We have a petting farm, so there's 3/4 of our petting farm animals are rescues. So we have to go out and take care of them, make sure they have fresh water, food, and that their pens aren't that messy and we can clean them out in time before people show up. After all that's done, like right now, pretty soon the weather breaks, we're going to start haying. So we'll get the chores all done and go start cutting fields and start the hay season. And if it's not a hay season, we're basically doing chores, and then we try to do one or two extra things like fix the fences. There's always something to do. There's always an animal trying to get out and breaks a fence, so we have to fix that fence.
Cows aren't the only animals at North Meadow, which has a petting farm and hosts school tours, along with its other visitors, to acquaint them with farming up close and personal. And selling its own products is one pathway out of the paradox dairy finds itself in, where fewer farmers are producing more milk, which keeps prices low. Then we journeyed up to Montpelier for conversations with Laura Ginsberg, dairy specialist with agricultural development for the state's Department of Agriculture, and Anson Tebbets, the state's agricultural secretary.
dairy is in a particularly challenging spot at the moment, where prices for commodity dairy producers have been low for a number of years, and we've seen quite a few dairy businesses exit the industry, either still farming otherwise, or they've retired, all out, or transitioned into other industries or working off the farm. What we are seeing is that there's not a great outlook for prices. So farms are in a position now where they're making some really tough choices. In the state and across the nation, we continue to see a decline in dairy farm numbers overall, with the outlook not looking great for a lot of farms. It is hard to keep in mind that some farms are actually doing okay and some are doing better than okay. They're doing well. It is all about planning and the amount of debt that farmers have and what markets they sell into and the choices that they've made as business owners over the years. But this continued long downturn in prices is really hurting everybody, from the small to the large, conventional, organic. All the producers are feeling the hard times right now.
Is there any pathway you see out of this? I mean, aside from, like, say, the federal government raising the dairy price support level, what is the route out?
Yeah, it's a great question. It's a hard solution because the problem is so complex. It's international markets, it's declining national consumer demand for fluid milk, but an increase in demand in other products. Dairy is not exactly a very elastic industry. Milk is produced daily. It has to be processed within a number of days, and most products cannot be stored long-term like other products. And so the industry itself can't adjust overnight to changing consumer preferences. So what we're really working on is figuring out how best to meet those changing consumer preferences, and also finding strategies that the farmers can use to either decrease their cost of production or become more resilient business owners throughout this downturn.
Well, I would say agriculture is always evolving. It always has, and there's some transition going along. It's been a rugged stretch for dairy, and we're trapped in a federal system. So we're working through some of those issues, trying to get farmers to a better place. One area that we are seeing tremendous growth in right now is in the world of hemp. Currently, latest figures, we have about 300 farmers who have decided to grow hemp, and that's about 3,500 acres. We expect much more. We're getting about 3 to 5 applications per day of people wanting to grow hemp in Vermont. So they register with us. So we know it's in Bennington County. We know it's in the rest of the 13 counties. So that area is it's got some potential, and we're seeing an opportunity to grow that industry as well.
What about organics? I mean, a few years ago, it seemed like organic farming was kind of the hot new thing and the wave of the future. Is that are we still seeing the same kind of growth and excitement in that area as we were seeing earlier?
On the dairy side, with organics, it is still a major player in Vermont. Now, the dairy industry in organics they're going through some of the growing pains as well as conventional. What has happened is there's too much organic milk out there, and some of the milk handlers, some of the companies have curtailed, so they're not buying as much. Most of the organic companies are not taking on new farmers because they have enough milk right now. So it's become, in a sense, a commodity just like conventional. So they're working through their growing pains as well.
And I was just thinking, I mean, Vermont historically and culturally is so identified with agriculture. Tourists who come here kind of half expect to see cows in a pasture and barns and working farms. Is there any sense that, you know, the state ought to be stepping in to kind of help farms that are struggling in order to keep that landscape, you know, happening and alive? Or is that just going to be a case of the free market's going to do whatever the free market is going to do?
Well, I think we have a role in government to be as supportive as much as we can. Of course, we don't have the resources to solve all the issues. We do have a program at the agency called the Working Lands Enterprise Initiative. And that is focused on actually productive agriculture land based on forestry, based on value added. So we can provide potentially grants to folks So if they need a piece of equipment that helps their cheese operation, or they have a situation where they need some help, they may be making wood products. We do have a grant program. We're granting out about $650,000 a year, all tied back to the working lands, productive agriculture. So we do not want Vermont to grow up to brush. It's part of why people come here. Tourism visitors are part of our landscape. We need to keep them coming here. And if it's not in productive agriculture, that's going to impact our tourist industry as well.
Jesse Pomeroy grew up working on a family farm in Londonderry and continued farming right on through. He described some of the differences between then and now.
Well, you used to be able to make a living milking 30, 40, 50 cows and shipping the milk. The prices were lower than they are now, but costs were lower too, and they kind of stayed in line with each other. And there were ups and downs in the price of milk, but the downs never lasted more than 6 months or a year, and then they rebounded. In the bad times, you cut back, and when the price came up again, you paid down debt. That's when you bought your new equipment. But the new norm, I guess, of dairy farming is that this downturn in price has been going on for 5 years, and who knows when it's going to end. And you can only operate below the cost of production for so long before you just can't do it anymore. Right now, there is more milk in this country than what we need. And in a way, we've been our own worst enemy, because for years we've been told, get big or get out. And when times were good, traditionally farmers added cows so they could make more milk, make more money. When times were bad, farmers added cows so they could make more milk and try to get out of debt. And we're just swimming in milk now. It, ironically, there are about a fifth or sixth of the dairy farms that there were back in the 60s in this country, but there's just about the same amount of cows. So the farms have gone from 50 cows to 5,000 cows. The farm I grew up on, my father milked 20 cows at the most, raised 4 kids. He had to do a little bit of part-time work off the farm, but in those days, a lot of people did. When I had my farm in Londonderry, I plowed 20 driveways in the winter to help make ends meet, and milking 55, 60 cows. But you do what needs to be done, but you're able to get by. And now, even with off-farm income and spouse working full-time off the farm, you're just barely scraping by, and it's a different picture. It's time, my opinion, it may be time to seriously look at quota, which had such socialistic overtones for years that nobody in this country wanted it. But now, maybe that's what we need to do. It's worked in Canada for years. The Canadian dairy farms have been viable for quite a while, but they get a decent price for the milk up to their quota limit, and then if they go over that, they get way below the cost of production, so there's no incentive to overproduce. And maybe that's what we need in this country now. I don't know. There's still a lot of resistance to it, but there's more and more of mainstream dairy farming that are ready to accept it. I see two scenarios in dairy farming in the Northeast. That we're going to have the huge farm still. A big farm in Vermont, 1,400, 1,500 cows, and they're not, I don't know if there's anything bigger than that, but there's a few of those. And so I see probably the majority of the milk being made by 500 to 1,500 cow farms. But farms like what we're doing here, small scale, not shipping milk, direct to the consumer, mixing in agritourism, that is the growing part of agriculture in the Northeast that I see, and there are farms all the time embracing this more and more, and I'm real optimistic about what we're doing here. I think it's going to work, but we will never get into the commodity market. All the milk we sell here is raw milk, or we run it through the cheese vat, and then if there's anything left over, we feed it to animals. So we use every drop of milk here on the farm. And then you do whatever else you can produce on the farm and sell it direct to the consumer. And I see that as what's going to keep Vermont agriculture going.
Milk prices have declined by over $7 per hundredweight since 2014, when they peaked at $23.63. Now a similar quantity of milk only sends a little over $16 into the dairy farmer's pocket. Until that changes, it will be hard to see the number of dairy farms growing again. For the GNAT TV News Project, I'm Andrew McKeever.
Listen, let's move that minefield over there. Let's talk about the SD card. The SD card now, you can probably explain it better than I can, but a lot of people have told me that everyone has a nice high-def camera now. We're not talking about phones. We're just talking about like we're being filmed on right now.
Or a still picture camera that also does video, things
right,
like that.
Listen, yeah. And so it's all using the SD card. And they're using these as storage, so some people have told me they've got like 10 stacked up on their bookshelf.
It does have a lifespan. You can write too much, you can read too much, and that can cause this...
I've had these fail.
Right, yep. And that causes that failure, or your data may be written, but it's corrupt.
Right.
So that's a problem there. But again, I think the lifespan of these, if, again, you know, you're taking care of them and they're kept in a somewhat reasonably climate-controlled area, I'd say 15 to 20 years. I mean, right. I feel like that's a safe estimate on...
And again, the connection device, I've got it. I know it's on there. It's good for 20 years. You still feel... And I'm not doubting you. Will I still in 15 years be able to push that into something and have it read?
I feel like, yes, for quite some time, I feel like there will be converters or something available that you can plug this into and it will, on the other end, have the of-the-day connector, if you will.
Right. So external hard drives are, in many ways, I know... They're like an SD?
They are very similar. So the big difference that I want to point out for anyone concerned about their, you know, updating their media to a current day storage device is that hard drives as we know them have predominantly been mechanical. That means there's a spinning disk and a moving head that reads that disk. And so those are points of failure. So as a hard drive ages... I get concerned about all those parts still working fluidly and properly. Whereas, again, this is volatile. The SD card is volatile, but there's no moving parts in here.
Right. Getting stuff off of dead hard drives, that sounds to me I'm hearing money again.
Yes. Again, you're paying someone to handle this problem for you. So, yeah, you're probably going to have to pay them. I think the cost can be very dependent on... the drive, the extent of the damage, we'll say, and the amount of information you're looking to get off that.
And if I decided that this was going to hold, like I was going to take everything off, I was going to stick it on this, and now it's full, and I'm going to put it on my shelf, is that a stupid thing to do? Again, 30 years from now, or even 40 years from now, is anybody going to be able to plug this into anything and get it off?
So I'll address the first part of that. In 20 or 30 years, if you stored this properly, and again, a non-fluctuating temperature room, we'll say, I think there's a very large possibility that the data will be absolutely fine, completely readable. And then to address the other part of that is, can I read it through this port? I would think that yes. Some sort of dongle, converter, something will be available to plug that into.
There's a difference now. The new one is solid state?
Right. So, again, typically, they've been HDD hard drive disk, and those are mechanical. And then more recently, in the last few years, the SSDs, which are solid state disk,
solid state, right,
Have come down quite a bit in price. And those are, I'd say, an even better
right.
storage.
That's where I'm going with that, actually. Right. So if this one are solid state, and we're going to use this as a storage device and try to send it 30 years in the future,
I would pick the solid state if I had to choose.
Even though it's newer technology?
So the thing about SSDs is they're basically like an SD card, but stronger, better, more reliable. They're meant to do long-term data storage. And again, whereas this has no moving parts, the SSD, no moving parts, just a little port, gets its power over that, very compact and simple. Also, the form factors tend to be much smaller than mechanical hard drives just due to the moving parts that need to exist.
Got it. Let's talk about phones, because it feels like right now we're shooting on a camera that we have here at GNAT. There's a good chance that his phone, this is Alex's phone, is actually better than the camera I'm using right now. And this seems to be such a wave of the future in terms of no one really is going to have those cameras unless they're after, I don't want to go nerdy on us, but after really good sound. These have good sound, but
yeah, these have acceptable sound.
These are great for everyday life.
So I think when it comes to phones,
and I should add in, the reason I wanted to talk about this is that I have a friend who has a dead phone. They never took any of the stuff off, so that phone is like this sitting on their bookshelf.
I think that's true for a lot of people. You know, you have your junk drawer that has a couple of the old phones in it,
right.
And those phones probably maybe have pictures, videos, memories of some kind on them. Depending on the age of the phone, all of a sudden that can become a really big problem. These are not as easily adapted to the future when your phone is older anyway. I'm talking about flip phones, the little plastic clamshells from years and years and years ago.
You mentioned earlier a Palm Pilot?
Right.
Right.
My wife used to have a Palm Pilot that shot video. That's the kind of thing I'm talking about, much different than what we think of a phone today. Those older devices often required a specific driver for your computer to be, so your computer could talk to that phone and say, hey, give me that data,
right.
Give me that movie, give me that picture. And so if you're unable to find that driver software, or if you're on an operating system that has no way to install that, you know.
Interesting. So you're branching up. You're going, like, I'm sitting here worrying about the physical connection, but what you're starting to now talk about is that there's actually two connections. There's a software connection and a physical connection. And if one's missing, and phones
are the most susceptible to this, and older phones in particular.
Because that's what everybody's using now.
Yes. Newer phones, iPhones, Androids, the way they do it now tend to be more like I'm plugging in a hard drive, and I can look at my files on there and pull them off and manipulate them that way.
Right.
I don't need a special driver to talk to it. So that's better nowadays. You're able to just instantly grab that off, or a lot of times they have the integrated services that let you upload to
automatically.
Right.
You're not really storing anymore. You're shooting and getting rid of immediately.
Right. And you're sending it to the cloud. And for those of you who don't know about the cloud is just someone else's computer, which is good and bad, I guess.
But before we get to the cloud, there's something you're hinting at, is that a lot of the early phones, the quality...
Okay, so yeah, so let's say everything went well for you. You're able to connect the device physically and through software, and now your computer is talking to it.
So my Palm Pilot from whenever. What is Palm Pilot for you? Was what, 12 years ago?
Yeah, about 12 years ago.
Okay, so Palm Pilot.
And so we got those videos off many years ago, or let's say now you're able to get those videos off. One of the things I think people will be surprised to encounter is the quality is lower than they remember. The degradation of the file can occur.
What way do you mean? Is is it this bad? Is it VHS bad?
It can be worse than VHS, and that's it comes down to a lot of the implementation of how the camera captured those images, the size of the sensor, the resolution.
And most people don't really know about that stuff.
Right. That's kind of behind the scenes stuff where it's like point and shoot, your video is done. This is kind of behind what's happening.
Only 15 years later do you realize that the resolution was so bad you can't even stand looking at it anymore.
Right. So I have some of those old videos that are 10 and 12 years old from this old Palm Pilot, and I watched one last weekend on my computer of today, and the quality was terrible. Wow. And
so that whole history of yours that you shot,
it's there. I suppose if you played it in a very small frame, and that's one of the other problems.
Yeah, will you explain that?
So the cameras of yesteryear used to capture a video that was about the size of a large postage stamp.
So we're looking, the video was that big.
Right, and when we're saying pixels, it's very few pixels. You know, common resolutions today are 1920 by 1080. That's a regular TV you have in your living room. That's the resolution. These videos were 320 by 240. So, you know, a sixth of that size.
So when you look at it on your nice new shiny TV of today, what happens?
Don't put it on full screen because you're going to be confused as what this blurry mess on your TV is. That's what it comes down to quite a bit, is just those phones of the time, it was a novel feature, right. But it wasn't, it's not the same as if you were to take a, let's say an over-the-shoulder type camera.
Right.
It's not.
So, Alex, if I was doing a doc on you, a documentary, you know, 20 years from now about your life, there'd be this whole stage where I don't have any video of you because it's too small to show on any viewable screen in today's world that people...
Right. That's accurate. And for me, it was kind of hard to go back and look at some of these videos and be like, wow, that is not a good rendition of that memory, so to speak. It was very blurry and...
That's not what I was hoping
for. Right,
so before we leave that, then your advice to people who are shooting... Because I swear to God, it seems like everyone is now shooting every home movie experience on their phone.
Yeah, phones are very good.
So that is it. That is the new reality. So what's your advice to people that are making this history that they want to send 30 years into the future?
Don't forget to download that onto a computer. Right. Or send that to a service that you have access to, that you can then download it from.
Are phones getting also so good that you don't have to worry about that quality? I mean, are they shooting so good now that the quality is there?
Yes. I'd say within the last 10 years, you know, the quality has skyrocketed on phones.
So take us from now, phones. One of the things you mentioned with phones is that instead of using them as a storage device when they die, they're immediately offloading the video now, if it's possible. So that's where we're now ending up in the cloud.
Right.
As you can tell, he wasn't a big fan of the cloud. I recently heard MySpace talking about they were trying to shift some files or something, and something went bad, and they went, oops, we lost a lot of thousands of people's stuff.
Right, and so that's something that can happen. And without them being able to have a way to get that back, it's gone. It's not coming back.
When you upload to the cloud, do they guarantee that you'll always be able to get your stuff back? Or is it in the small print that says, good luck?
I think that really depends on the company, the service, and what you're expecting of it. But oftentimes, if they go belly up, it doesn't matter if there was a guarantee to have your file.
Right, there's no money.
Right.
So let's take Facebook. Let's say, I know a lot of people upload family stuff to Facebook.
I would recommend against that for multiple reasons. One is oftentimes they drop the quality.
So it never looks good again. So even if they gave it back to you, let's say I lost my copy because I didn't make a copy, and Facebook says, yeah, here it is.
Right.
We could be back to, oh, thanks for the VHS copy of my home movie.
Kind of, sort of. When you've seen digital video, people kind of have an idea of that looks off. Something is wrong there. Okay. And that is oftentimes what tends to happen. The resolution is shrunk, the bitrate is turned down. And so even if you were to say, oh, thankfully Facebook gave me this back, it's not the same video as you uploaded.
Right. So you get what you paid for.
Right. Which was nothing. That's a free service, and that's what you get.
Now, the cloud service, you're going to have to pay to keep your stuff at the quality you sent it up. Is that correct?
I think you need to look more closely at what service you're uploading to. Because some make that guarantee, others don't. Others are, again, not manipulating, but gathering information on what you uploaded and then selling that, because like there has to be some value for a free service somewhere.
Okay. So in conclusion, what you do yourself right now is what?
I try to keep my media on a relatively recent medium, we'll say. You know, I don't have any Super 8s. I don't have any VHS. I don't have any DV tapes. I've moved away from DVDs. Right now, things are stored on essentially SD, my internal computer's hard drive, and I don't have any cloud services. So that's one thing where I'm falling short on if I'm really concerned about the safety of my data.
So you got it on your computer and you got it on an external storage device of some kind, usually an SD.
It's a USB 3 flash drive.
Got it.
So which isn't perfect. You know, that can corrupt, that can break, that can be lost.
But you know you've got two.
Yes.
So the odds are something's going to survive.
Right. Okay.
All right. Whew. Man, you know, we could probably do this 10 years from now, and it's a whole other world.
Absolutely.
And the same situation still exists, is passing it on to the future is a never-ending chore.
It really is never-ending, and part of that is, again, like you were saying, technology is always changing. The connector, the connections, the software, the hardware, things are always changing, hopefully improving.
Yeah, right.
And sometimes it makes it easier for us to get these older things to the newer thing. And on what I think will become much more easily as time goes on is digital to digital.
Mm.
Whereas a lot of this stuff is analog to analog, and analog to digital can be difficult. And digital to digital will be much easier in the future.
All right, so last thing. If I've got any of this old stuff, your advice is?
Get it to today's standard, the digital format. These things...
Get it off.
Yeah, these have a shelf life. And even if they're well taken care of and these tapes and discs or in films may still work in 20 or 30 years, do you have the player? Do you have the connections? Right. Do you have the software, et cetera?
Yeah. I could leave all this stuff to my children's and their children's, and they'll just all be pissed at great-great-grandpa for never taking care
of
it.
The box of film and VHS will just be pushed along one generation.
To the next. All right, folks. Thank you so much, Alex.
You're welcome.
Haas, GNN News. We'll see you next time.
Recently, GNAT met with Southern Vermont Arts Center's new executive director to learn about their new creative spaces for 2019.
Hello, I'm Ann Corso, the executive director here at the Southern Vermont Arts Center, and I'm very excited to launch two of our new spaces here at SVAC. What we're looking at now is our library resource room, and this is a space that we've developed for a couple of purposes. It's a place where students and scholars can come and study and relax and peruse both our collection of artist books. And we're also excited for our inaugural exhibition here to partner with the Artist Book Foundation out of Massmoka, who has donated an incredible selection of artist books to us for the public to enjoy. And this is also a space where people can come for group meetings. Imagine art curriculum supervisors wanting to get off campus and have a great place for a meeting, a little brainstorming session. So this is a space that's available for many segments of our community to meet, relax, enjoy, and learn. And next, I want to show you our family space. So follow me. So we are really excited to launch this new space here at the Southern Vermont Arts Center because ArtVenture is a place just for families and specifically for families with kids. So it's a space where we have created artwork just for our family audiences. Our ArtVenture wall here has been painted on the walls and is a lot of inspiration for the activities that happen in this room. As everyone can see, we have activities, art activities, where kids of all ages can come and make their own artwork and install it up here on the Flutter Wall. And even we're building a library of books, specifically art books, so that parents, grandparents, and kids of all ages can have something to do here and learn and enjoy and relax here in the Art Venture space. So there are many, many exciting things happening this summer at Southern Vermont Art Center. Classes, camps, performances, and of course, our favorite space, Art Venture. So come and see us anytime this summer.
The long-awaited Putnam Block redevelopment in downtown Bennington is finally underway. A celebration to mark the occasion was held on the front steps of the former Putnam Hotel on the Four Corners intersection, where actual construction work was scheduled to begin on Tuesday, June 18th. The first phase of what is expected to be about a $54 million project involves renovation of the historic hotel and the immediately adjacent buildings to either side of it on South Street and Main Street. On Friday, June 14th, a closing on an extremely complex financing package involving multiple state agencies and private institutions was reached for the first phase of the project, when valued at around $27.6 million. This will allow the work on the three buildings to start.
Today is just a little bit of a local sort of celebration to sort of say that we did this. That was a huge accomplishment. 2.5 years, a lot of work, for a whole bunch of reasons that we won't get into. But without this community support and the people here, it would have never happened. So thank you all for coming and enjoy our little celebration. And maybe we'll get a photograph for the record for the next
Bill Colvin, the Assistant Director and Community Program Coordinator of the Bennington County Regional Commission, who is also the liaison for the Bennington Redevelopment Group, LLC, which is formally overseeing the project and which has been several years in the planning and development, described Tuesday's event and where things would be going from here.
Today really is just a small celebration among the group and a few community members to recognize that after 3 long years and $30 million of financing, financing's in place. Construction will commence this week on phase one of the redevelopment of the Putnam Block project. 74,000 square feet of mixed use, retail, residential, commercial space in downtown Bennington. Really a transformative event for our community. There are countless partners that we need to thank, and we'll do that at an official groundbreaking later this summer. But today is just a small acknowledgement, one, for the group, because this closing all happened remotely, to be in one place at one time and celebrate together, and secondly, to really offer thanks to the community for their patience and support throughout this process, and let the community know that, yes, in fact, took a little longer than we hoped and thought, but this is happening, we're certainly hopeful that downtown Bennington is going to change dramatically for the better.
The second and third phases of the project will be following and will include more buildings across a four-acre site in the heart of downtown Bennington. They will include construction of a multi-story building for medical offices, for the Southwestern Vermont Medical Center, and other commercial space as well as housing units. A third phase will include more housing along Washington Avenue. Southern Vermont Medical Center CEO Tom Dee spoke about the hospital's involvement in the project.
Well, as the largest employer in this area here, we felt it was critical for us to take a major role in this project. I can think of no other project that's going to impact our Southern Vermont region more than this one. So really, at the urging of Jim Brown, the president of the Bank of Bennington, we got together and we talked about what could we do collectively as a group of leaders to really help in the revitalization of Bennington. And this one, you know, clearly came to the surface right away that if we could do this project, this could act as a catalyst for more redevelopment in the whole Southern Vermont Bennington region. So we're very happy and honored to be part of it.
Some initial environmental remediation work has already begun, but in the next few weeks, activity is going to be much more visible and intense as the gut renovation of the first three buildings in the initial phase gets underway. The Bennington Redevelopment Group, which is overseeing the project and has been nursing it along through the financing phase, is a consortium of local entities and individual investors, which include the Bank of Bennington, Southwestern Vermont Healthcare, Bennington College, Dimitri Gardner, and Global Z International, Brian and Jennifer McKenna, Anthony and Jacqueline Morrow, Sheila and Elizabeth Harden, M&S Development, and Four Putt Properties, LLC. SVMC's Tom D. described what their ultimate hopes for the project are.
I think it's going to have a major impact in the economics of the area as well as the overall feeling and mentality about downtown Bennington. It's going to be a place to live and work and play.
A larger groundbreaking ceremony is planned to take place later this summer. For the GNAT TV News Project, I'm Andrew McKeever. An unusual and one-of-a-kind piece of art will be on display at the Helmholtz Gallery in Manchester through June 29th. Created by the husband and wife team of Steve and Eve Schaub of Paulet, the nearly 30-foot-long photo collage depicts the history of Rokeby, an estate located in Ferrisburg, Vermont, which in the years before the Civil War was a stopping point along the Underground Railroad, through which slaves, fleeing plantation life in the South, escaped to freedom. But Rokeby's fascinating history doesn't end there. The estate, owned by the Robinson family, was a farm beginning in the 18th century and became a museum in 1961. The artwork created by the Schaubs includes both written and photographic elements, which they explained while hanging the long piece of art that will be the centerpiece of an exhibit that will be on display at Helmholtz Fine Art through June 29th.
We were asked, Steve and I, to make an artwork at the Rokeby Museum, and my husband made this beautiful, enormous in-camera collage on film of all the, combining many different views of the Rokeby homestead and the many different buildings that are still in existence there today. And then I went through many of the materials from the Rokeby archive with the assistance of the curator and worked to come up with text that we would then integrate into the artwork. And then I hand-inscribed all these different pieces that came from the many different parts of the history. It was such a rich, amazing, fascinating history with so many different dimensions that I felt that the photograph would reflect that, and we wanted the text that was inscribed to also reflect that. So we have, poetry, we have speeches, we have a handbill here that was posted advertising an anti-slavery convention that the Robinsons were part of. They invited Frederick Douglass to come and speak in Ferrisburg, which he did. So I included part of his speech in the text that was written on the artwork. And this became one of my most favorite parts of the work. It's an incredible, fiery speech. Frederick Douglass, of course, being a former slave himself. And so the Robinsons harbored runaway slaves. They gave them jobs if they wanted them to work on the farm. Some of them wanted to proceed to Canada, but they were very safe in Vermont. Vermont did not extradite. There was no extradition of slaves. They didn't want to be bothered with that. And they were far enough away that slave hunters did not. It wasn't worth their while to come and get them. So slaves often would stay for years and work on the Robinson family farm. So we don't have in the collection of the museum any writings from those people who lived on the farm, who were part of that Underground Railroad history. So one of the things I was thinking about a lot when I was inscribing on the artwork was, how do you represent those voices that we don't have the actual words? And so that's how I got the idea to have a handprint in the work. And that was my idea for representing the people whose words we don't have.
Okay, so I was asked to make a piece for Rokeby by Rick Cassini-Cadour, who is the contemporary art curator at the Rokeby Museum. And I was doing these in-camera collages on film. I had made one piece already that had writing and imagery that my wife and I had teamed up on, Eve. And I went to Rokeby. It was a really cold winter day. And this is all what's called an in-camera collage on film. So it's not shot digitally. It's shot with the film camera, and it's shot with the camera called a Noblex. The Noblex, the lens physically rotates from side to side, so you get a 140-degree angle of view. So it's like human vision. But then there are overlapping frames of film. So all these lines that you see, these sort of cinematic lines that are going throughout the piece, are negatives overlapping. So the scene that you're seeing here doesn't exist. This is sort of, it's not linear. You know, this is from one side of the barn or the field, this is from another area. So it's put together as this collage on the film, and it's sort of the illogic of a dream of the place. And what inspired me when I was walking around Rokeby was the forest. And it was this, you know, really stark, cold Vermont winter day. And I'm looking at all the trees and how you wind through the trees. And I was thinking that same sort of experience with the Rokeby farm itself is all these buildings, and you're winding between the narrows of the buildings. And of course, I'm always being conscious when I'm making the work, trying to leave places for Eve to be able to write and to have text, because there's such a wealth of information and history on the Rokeby family and the Underground Railroad, or the Robinson family and the Underground Railroad. The artwork itself is printed on a paper called Harukishi, which is a cloud dragon paper from Japan made by Awagami. And it's printed as a carbon print, so it's 12 dilutions of pure black carbon on the handmade Japanese paper. And it works out at just under 30 feet in length.
Gallery owner Lisa Helmholtz-Adams described what she thought made the Schaub's work unique and significant.
And with Rokeby, it's another thread continuing with Steve and now Eve, which I just find so amazing because it is our beautiful state, it is historical, and it's art. And he's been able to pull that together, and also his famous wife, who's also an incredible writer, and bring her into it. It is just, I have no words. I'm absolutely blown away by this. I'm excited that it's here at Helmholtz Fine Arts. So in the southern part of Vermont, we can really see this and appreciate it. And also,
a discussion about Rokeby, its history, and the unusual piece of art the Schaubs have created will take place during an opening reception at the gallery on Saturday, June 22nd. For the GNET TV News Project, I'm Andrew McKeever.
Thanks for listening local. For more local content, visit GNAT.tv.